You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, I'm your host Eli Sussman, and welcome to a special episode of The Line. Today, you'll hear the audio recording of a live event I recently hosted called Lessons Learned, Tales from Small Business Owners. The event featured captivating stories from four business owners who shared their personal story in the restaurant business. In between each speaker, I've shared a few stories of my own. The event took place at the Tillett Showroom in New York City in October of 2022. Special thanks goes out to the event partner TD Bank and our hosts, the founder of Tillett, Jenny and Alex, and of course, our storytellers. The first small business storyteller you will hear is Eric Wang, chef and owner of Pecking House, Brooklyn. An 11 Madison Park alum, the pandemic caused Eric to re-examine his career and led him to start a fried chicken pop-up. He found that fried chicken made him rethink everything and that his own restaurant opening has led him to pursue a different model and mindset in terms of employment, teamwork, and hospitality. Johnny Sparrow of Bar Sparrow in Washington, D.C. told the story of finally opening his Georgetown restaurant Reverie. But after finally opening and even receiving a Michelin star, he had to face the devastation and shock when awoken in the middle of the night by a 4 a.m. phone call as he rushed to his restaurant to find that it had completely burned down. Difficult to fully deconstruct in only a short period, he gives us a glimpse into his psyche of how he's navigating such a complex and emotional road back to reopening. Jahira Gonzalez of Pop and Pour in Washington Heights spoke about her business surviving the pandemic. Her strength came from her ability to find positives even in the face of mounting adversity. She talks about making sure to do your research before making decisions, being flexible at all times, understanding sacrifices you may need to make, and to lean on others for help when needed. Closing out the evening was Buddy the Bar's Claire Sprouse, who owned the just recently closed Hunky Dory in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. Although she built a beautiful community restaurant that received many accolades, the timing of the pandemic and the need to prioritize her personal life helped her make the almost impossible decision to permanently close the restaurant. In her first time speaking publicly about the closing, Claire speaks about coming to the decision to close and cautions that anyone considering the restaurant industry should take a deep look at what they really want to do before truly jumping in. Every restaurant is filled with stories of failure, success, and everything in between. The Line has always been about chefs and owners sharing their own stories, and I'm honored to bring these four stories to you today. Now, on to the episode.
Thank you so much, and thanks everyone for coming. So, of course, tonight is all about storytelling, and that's what my podcast is about. The Line is a opportunity for chefs and restaurant owners to, in a long format, talk about the trajectory of their career. So it's a one-on-one interview with me. And basically the reason that I started it was because I left my chef job to open my own business and I didn't know what I was doing. I thought I had it figured out. And what you realize very quickly when you go to open up your own business is that you have nothing figured out. So I thought, oh, this is great. I'll just invite all these really accomplished people onto this podcast and I'll just, you know, really hammer them with questions and they can tell me about all the stupid things that they've done and I won't make any of those mistakes. The problem is that I opened my restaurant and I made every single one of those stupid mistakes and then I made 100 more. So in between everyone tonight, I'm going to tell you a couple quick stories about my experience as a restaurant owner. You can determine whether, you know, they're idiotic or whether you know, there's something to take away from them. But I think one of the most amazing things about being a small business owner is that you often live and die by your own decisions. That can be a very lonely and scary and dangerous place to be. So a lot of the stories that are going to be shared tonight are people telling you vulnerable stories about them experiencing maybe highs but often very lows about their career. So it's exciting to have an amazing group of storytellers with us tonight, and sharing some of, you know, maybe the most tumultuous aspects of their professional careers. And as we know, when people work in the hospitality industry, your professional career is your personal life as well. So these aren't just their careers, this is their lives. They are fully intertwined. So a quick story, and then we're going to start with our first official storyteller. My restaurant in Williamsburg, we quickly realized that we needed to really embrace catering to be successful. And we partnered with Etsy, which has an office in Dumbo, and they had this amazing program to tap local restaurants to cater their office lunches. It was a great opportunity for us. We were a small business and we really wanted to knock it out of the park. We'd work with them a couple times and we had often tried to, you know, every single time up the quality and expansiveness of the menu. So basically what you do with Etsy is you are required to bring enough food to feed 550 people. Okay, so they have a cafeteria in their office and boom, you bring the food, everyone walks in, they have four lines, like hot lines in a cafeteria, they grab plates and those people, they mob it. It's free lunch, right? So they go crazy. So you spend about 3 days prepping before in the restaurant and then you bring all the food over, right? So after a very long day of opening and closing the restaurant, I had left one of our team there to finish cooking all the chicken, cutting it and cooling it in the walk-in, all right? 400 pounds of chicken for 550 people and about 1,000 pounds of other things, rice and some greens. So we felt good. I went to bed and at about 5 a.m, I woke up and I thought, you know what? I should just head over to the restaurant. And I opened up the walk-in and I was hit with that funky smell of something being wrong, right? So when you cool chicken improperly, when you put hot chicken on top of warm chicken and you stack it in a Lexan and a Cambro, things don't cool properly. And what it smells like is terrible. It smells like farts. And so I knew that something was wrong. So I went out to the back alley and I said every curse word that could possibly exist. And then I came back into the restaurant and my brother, who is my business partner, I called him and he only lived a couple blocks away and I said, you gotta get over here. We gotta figure out what to do. And he walked in and I said, what are we gonna do? We gotta call him, we gotta cancel. And he said, we're not gonna cancel, we need this. We need this income and we need to deliver or else you're never gonna call us again. So what did we do? He said, fire up the ovens, cook all the chicken that we have. So we were very, very lucky that the day prior we had gotten our chicken delivery to marinate it, right? So we actually had the product there. The problem was we had 400 pounds of raw chicken sitting next to 400 pounds of cooked chicken. So it was just the two of us and we kicked it into gear and over the next 30 minutes, two more people came in. An hour later, two more people came in and we cooked 400 pounds of chicken. I called our contact at Etsy and I said, lunch is gonna be late, but I promise it's gonna be delicious. And I took my little beater Prius and we threw cooked chicken in the back of it in about 150 pound batches. And we sent someone in a cab over to Etsy and we ran chicken in 3 rounds over to Etsy. Were they happy? They were okay about it. They liked the ingenuity of us delivering the meal. But the takeaway that I have is that, you know, every problem has a solution. Every terrible thing that happens inside of a restaurant has, you have a choice. There's a fork in the road. There's, do I crumble in a ball and cry and say, I've just lost my $12,000 catering and this month is shot? Or do I say, let's try to make something happen? So we made it work. We did as good of a job as we could do in that situation and they let us come back. And that was the key to, you know, solving that problem. It also teaches you a lot about how to present yourself to your employees when they come through the door. If you're frantic and you throw the blame at somebody else, you've probably lost the catering, lost an employee, and you've probably lost your control over the environment. So it was a big learning experience for me. Looking to my brother as not only a partner, but someone with more experience on how to deal with that situation. So we turned a negative into a positive. And I think that if you can do that 50, 60% of the time in the restaurant, you can keep the doors open and keep the lights on. So we're going to bring up our first storyteller right now. Eric, come on up.
gonna sit. There's a stool here. That's why I started playing the cello, because sitting is better than standing, playing the violin. All right, my name is Eric Huang. I am the chef owner of Pecking House. We have just opened our first brick and mortar after a very long 2-year journey existing as a transient nomadic restaurant doing pop-ups in Queens and my family's restaurant, through renting some space at my friend's restaurant in Brooklyn, and now we finally have our own restaurant and we built out our own space, and it was a hell of a journey. I'm gonna try to keep things as positive as possible, because I could sit up here and complain endlessly about how owning a restaurant sucks, but we're gonna try to keep it a little more lighthearted. So I worked in fine dining for forever and ever, over 12 years in New York City, and that keeps you in a very specific box. My last job before starting Pecking House was at a restaurant that Eli likes to make fun of called 11 Madison Park. I was the sous chef there, and that restaurant appears in his account a lot. But it's a very myopic, narrow-minded, tunnel vision kind of approach to hospitality, right? And at that time, you're told it's the objective superlative. This is the best of the best of the best. This is what everyone should be striving towards. And that was my goal forever. That was my North Star. I followed that forever. No matter how hard life was, how hard the job was, how many setbacks I had, I followed that. You know, one day I'm going to open a restaurant, and it's going to be even better than that. It's going to be, you know, doing way more than 11 Madison Park ever hoped to, you know, for people of color, for my culture as a Chinese American, et cetera, et cetera. But then obviously some stuff happened in spring of 2020. We had a little bit of a pandemic, and just a slight change of plans. So I took to helping my family restaurants out. That's what happened. I was helping my mom out, doing takeout, making dim sum, which was crazy. And then eventually I helped my uncle out. His restaurant had been shuttered since lockdown. Was anybody able to keep it open? And I just started this little fried chicken thing, and was figuring out how to deliver fried chicken. And yes, I know it's stupid to deliver fried chicken, but fryers were the only thing that worked there. So figuring out how to deliver to New Yorkers, and I never ever planned on it being a, to take off, to have success. I, always used the joke that it was an unplanned pregnancy. Ironically, I'm the only panelist that does not have children. So that's exactly what it was. You know, it was stressful, it was totally unexpected, it was crazy, you're just figuring things out on the fly. But at the end of the day, something incredibly grateful for and really appreciative of. So I think even for a long time though, even though Pecking House was, enjoying a lot of success and doing really well in the press, and all these New Yorkers locked in their apartments, desperate for a really good meal, it was going well, I still was very obsessed with this idea of doing fine dining and, opening a fine dining restaurant. And it took me a long time to realize, this food really makes people happy. It's so approachable, it's so comforting, and that's what really made me want to make it a real thing. And, it made sense in that regard to try to open a new kind of restaurant in the wake of the pandemic and to do something different. I mean, if we had a globally cataclysmic event like the pandemic and you went back to doing things exactly the way it was before, I mean, like, boo on you, that's pretty lame. So we, always tried to approach it like, if we're going to do this, we got to do it really differently. And that meant from, everything from how we take out garbage, how we recycle, committing to composting, and how we especially treat staff. I was a cook in New York City for over 10 years, and that's not an easy thing to do. And you're making, when I first started as a cook here, making $9.50 an hour, it was common practice to be told to go clock out, but yet go back to work. So it's like, why should we keep continuing to prop up these systems of exploitation and privilege and unrealistic expectations? So we really, really tried to do things differently. But of course, that's super hard. There are systems and precedent for the way we do things for decades, if not centuries, and trying to upend everything, even though everything has changed, is not easy. Just committing to not using plastic wrap. I mean, I never used third pan lids and hotel pan lids ever. Like, we just plastic wrapped everything, right? But it's like, this is so stupid. Why are we putting tons and tons of plastic into the garbage? That's with its challenges, because, buying lids is expensive, maintaining lids the right way is expensive. Composting, I never composted ever. We just threw everything right in the trash. It's a little challenging to explain to the Department of Health that the meat sitting out is rotting at a controlled pace. We got this under control. We know what we're doing. Okay, all right. Everything like that. But most importantly, you know, I wanted to treat people differently. And, you know, everybody here who's in hospitality and restaurants know how hard it is to hire, how difficult it was to work with, for so little money to work that hard. And so we really wanted to figure it out differently. I did a little pop-up in California for a month, and it was super, super busy. I was really grateful for it, but we were getting crushed. We just totally weren't expecting it. And I was really confused. Like, all the cooks, like, seemed pretty, like, cheerful about it. And they're like, oh, man, like, we're getting crushed. I was like, what is going on? Like, California, like, legalized marijuana, just the attitude. I don't know what it is. Like, everyone's super happy about this. Like, in New York, I was just, like, bitter every time I heard the ticket printer start going. But then I learned, they were like, oh, well, you know, we get tips. And I was like, whoa, that's not a thing in New York, you know? Like, so the busier the restaurant is, they get a return on investment there. And that made total sense to me. Everybody, from a morale standpoint, you know, even if it's not a significant amount of money, they feel invested in the success of the restaurant. So I wanted to take that back to New York. Like, how do we figure that out? And, you know, as you can imagine, with everything in New York City, with bureaucracy and laws, it's complicated. It's confusing. There's a reason people haven't really done that, but I was really committed to figuring it out. You know, everybody here who has professionally cooked, it sucks to take home $10 an hour while servers are, like, counting stacks of gold, like, at the pass, and you're sucking down degreaser at the stove, you know? So that's not a really pleasant exercise in humanity. So we really wanted to figure that out. And, you know, turns out if you pay everybody minimum wage and, you know, you structure things in a certain way, you can share the tip pool around everyone. And I didn't know how that was gonna work, but after a couple of weeks, we realized, hey, like, this is great for everyone. Everyone's contributing. Everyone's part of the tip pool. Everyone does super well. And everyone's making over $22, $23 an hour. And I didn't think it would go that well. and, you know, tipping as a system is something we can certainly talk about endlessly. I don't love it, but it is here for better or worse. But at the very least, we can use it to our benefit. And it's, you know, not even, you know, coming close to anything that would be considered exploitative. We're talking like 18% tip averages on a $40 check. Using that to able to split the resources, now cooks are making over $22 an hour, front house people are making over $22 an hour, and it really works out. You know, I think every restaurant, every hospitality group in the city loves to preach the one team, one dream thing, or like, we're a family, which is like the most toxic, you know, thing you could possibly say. What you're basically saying is like, oh, we all have undiagnosed mental health problems and you gotta suck it up. I very much strive to avoid that term family, but it is a team. Everyone's invested in the success of the restaurant. If it's busy, the cooks do well. If it's busy, the dining room team does well. And, you know, there's no like, oh, this is my job, this is your job. You know, everyone's like hauling trash, everyone's cleaning bathrooms, you know. It's like, just completely changes the mindset of how you approach a restaurant and how you approach this collaborative teamwork environment. And, you know, I wish I could say I knew it was going to go that well. And, you know, like, oh, I totally knew. It was great. But, you know, I had no idea it was going to work out as well as it did. But it's, you know, not even just from a financial perspective, from a morale and attitude mindset, it's been so amazing. And you know, as I'm sure everyone here can talk about, there's a lot of really hard parts about owning a restaurant, a lot of failures, a lot of personal mistakes. You know, the build out went over budget how many times did I have to go back to the bank for money, go back to the investors for money? That stuff hurts so bad. But these little victories and these things that go well, I think we all have to really appreciate when things work out and your ingenuity and, you know, taking a leap of faith on something and having it work out. And that's by no means easy, but I think it's worthwhile to commit to doing something differently, especially in the wake of something that completely upended our industry. So I'm very grateful to say that Pecking House is doing well in that regard. And I never planned on being a fried chicken chef, but here we are.
Thank you. We're going to bring up our next storyteller. Tira?
Really?
Yeah.
Hi. My name is Jahira Gonzalez, and I own Pub and Port Wine Bar. We're located on 200 Dyckman Street. That's in the Inwood area, or all the way uptown. So let me tell you how this happened. You know, my original concept or my original idea was not even a restaurant. It was a wine boutique. It was AKA a liquor store. So, you know, I do all my due diligence. I do my research. You know, I talk to whoever I can talk to. And this was about 2015. And in 2017, I decided, okay, you know what? I'm ready. I'm going to do this. I found my space. I fell in love with it. Unfortunately, someone who already had a liquor store, which was a small little bulletproof liquor store, decided that they wanted to oppose us opening. Fine. It's fine. You know what? I went back and said, you know, this is what I'm trying to do. I had all my pictures, all my projects, everything. And I go back to the SLA and I'm like, listen, this is very different to what this man has like 3-4 blocks away. I wasn't going to interfere with his business. He wasn't going to interfere with mine. I knew that because it was a completely different concept than what he had. That didn't work. That didn't work. So, you know what? I went in. I was denied the liquor license that first time. I went the second time. This time I was 8 months pregnant. So when I was denied, I cried all the way home. I cried. I called one of my best friends and I'm like, listen, you know, I fucked up. I don't know what I'm going to do. She's a chef. At the time, she was a sous chef. So we talked about it, and this would be her opportunity to just kind of shine in the kitchen, to do her own thing, to, you know, work with me. You know, we were going to work together. We get along perfectly. So we spoke about it, we did our research, we did everything and anything that you can think of just to make sure that this was gonna work. So, you know, while I'm doing all that and while I was waiting for that liquor license, of course, and I probably should have said that before, we had already, mistake number one, started building. So luckily it was just shelves. So it wasn't too much, you know, Home Depot. So I had to bring all that stuff down again. She worked on her menu. That menu had to be small plates, tapas style, because we have an electric kitchen. The space that I chose, another mistake, didn't have an existing kitchen. This was a women's accessory store that I was going to turn into a wine boutique. So we had to, brainstorm and bring in all that good stuff, all those electrical machines. And you know what, after that, you know, she did her magic in the kitchen. I worked on the on our wine list, beer as well, you know, because once I went back that third time, I did get a liquor license, but they only approved the wine and beer. if anyone is familiar with the Dyckman area, it's very active. It's a party area, you know. Not too many people really go for wine. So the reason why I wanted to bring in the wine boutique was because I wanted to somewhat educate, and I knew that there was that crowd. I know it's still there. But fine, you know what? I was persistent and I said, this is what's gonna happen. And you know, I already have the space. I've already invested this money. So I'm gonna open up as Bob and Poor Cafe. So when we first opened, it was February 14th of 2017. It was great. It was a success. You know, it's a cozy establishment. Dim lights. You can have a conversation, whereas the rest of the places, it's, you know, party and a lot going on. So it worked. It worked for us. But, you know, in my heart, I still have that love for the wine, that love for that wine boutique, for that AKA liquor store. I don't know how we even made it work. She had more experience than I did because this was not what I wanted to do. So I had to learn as I went. You know, as time passed, I had to learn. I learned to bartend. The only place I did not touch was the kitchen. And I still don't touch it. But, you know, I had to bartend. I've had to mop the floors. I've had to be the dishwasher. I've had to be everything and anything that you can think of in that place. But I love it, and it did make me stronger. I feel that after this, you know, it's a very hard industry. So after this, I feel like I can take on whatever. You know, just bring it on. Bring it on. I can do it. I am blessed, though. Then, you know, like most of us in the industry, I was hit with COVID, of course, and I lost people. I lost employees. And it kind of just set me back a couple of years. When COVID came to, you know, I don't even know what word to use for it. It was my third year, 2020. So that's when I was seeing a little bit of a little air. I was breathing. I was, you know, things were different. But it, like I said, it set me back. So I felt like I had to kind of start over. That was depressing. And I went through my ups and downs. I went to therapy. That helped. That helped. But today, you know what? We were able to overcome all that. And I see things going forward. And I'm very happy to be here. Very blessed. I don't think I would change anything. Because like I said, it's made me much, much stronger.
Okay, so before our next story, which is pretty heavy, I'll offer you a brief moment of levity, which is for 4 years, I operated a business down in the Rockaways as a pop-up, sort of a subset second location of a business that I had operating. So if you're familiar with Jacob Riis Beach, there is an area that has sort of little vendors that are all in a row. And so I had two concepts that were down there, and we prepped in Williamsburg and I drove it down. So, you know, what's better than being a business owner who gets to spend all day on the beach, right? Where my head was at is, all right, I get up at 9 a.m, I pick up the prep at the restaurant, I'm down at the beach by 11, toes in the sand by 11:30, maybe I get a frozen drink from the bar and, you know, answer some emails. So I'm heading down to the beach, bringing down prep for both restaurants. So my car is fully loaded. And I've got chili for my Coney Island concept. I've got pickled vegetables for my Middle Eastern Mediterranean concept. And as I'm driving down, I'm on the BQE and got the windows down, and my cell phone rings. And, you know, I'm a big, important restaurant owner, so, like, I've got to check my cell phone. You know, what if someone calls me at the restaurant and says the Department of Health is there? You know, what if it's, you know, who knows? So, as I'm fumbling for my cell phone to check it and answer it, the car in front of me swerves, and someone pulls into my lane. And I look up right at the right time to slam on my brakes, and a 12 quart of labneh, which is yogurt, basically, that someone had used a lid that didn't match the Cambro and had double wrapped in plastic, went flying from the back of my car and flew in the air, and the bottom of it caught another Cambro and 12 quarts, which, if you can imagine what 12 quarts looks like, it's like, it's literally the most liquid you could ever imagine, right? It's a bathtub crime scene full of labneh, right? And I feel it hit my neck. I see it hit the dash. It's 96 degrees. So I pull into the back parking lot of Jacob Riis, and the staff is there to meet me to put everything in the walk-in. And a guy walks up to the car and he goes, "Hey man, you know you've got a spill back here, right?" Yes, I'm aware that I have a spill back there. So everyone, all the other vendors jumped in and everyone did their best to try to help me clean everything off. We got everything into the walk-in. To the best of our ability, we got all the, if you've seen Pulp Fiction, when they clean like the big, sort of like that, towels scooping up Lobna and Brain out of my car. And fast forward a year later to my, at that time, girlfriend, who is now my wife, and she's in my car, and she says, "You know, you always drive with your windows down, and I kind of noticed your car smells really bad. Do you know that?" And I said, "Yeah, it's because of the Lobna incident." So so that moment of levity to offer you that, you know, again, a restaurant owner, you never know what's going to happen. Bad things happen. Hopefully people help you out. It's all about what you do after the bad thing happens, I think, that that can define you. Not the incident, but how you maybe decide your path to move forward.
Johnny, come on. Segue the worst thing to fucking happen. Here we go.
Well, yeah. Kind of set the tone for this. This is like, I guess, the rise and the fall, and I guess, hopefully, the eventual rise again. So, I'm Johnny Spiro. I own a restaurant in Georgetown in DC called Reverie, as well as a new restaurant, Bar Spiro. It's pretty cool. I like that place. So I moved back to DC. DC's been my on again, off again home. I love it and hate it. It's like a super healthy relationship. I moved back, wanted to open my own restaurant. I did it once when I was 26. Didn't work out so well. Thought I would try it again. Opened it in 2018, October 6th. October 16th, my daughter was born. So like, I'm really good at timing that stuff out because I just did it again. Pandemic happened. I had another baby. And then I have a 3-week-old at home right now. So I know where babies come from now, and it's kind of nuts. So we're stopping there. But we opened the restaurant. I had partners, and they are no longer partners anymore. You know, it was a struggle from day one. Everyone knows opening a restaurant is terribly difficult to find your voice. And after a year, you know, it was basically a wash. We had lost some money, and we're like, okay, let's, if we're going to fail, let's do it the way we want to do it. We're going to, you know, just do tasting menu, just do 100% seafood, be the restaurant we want to be. And then the pandemic happened. And they're like, great, we're gonna do burgers and that's how we're gonna get by. Made it through pandemic, went back to doing tasty menus. We went through so many different things just to keep our staff paid, to keep my family paid, to keep, you know, my wife and family healthy at home. And we don't go into that, we don't have enough time for that shit. But, you know, this year in, what was it, 2022, we were pushing really hard. We have like an amazing staff. Our goal was never to, you know, we never went for accolades or anything like that. It was like, let's just have fun. Let's cook the food we want to cook and have a good time. And we got a Michelin star for that. So that was dope. And then that was when we saw the reservations tick up. We're like, oh shit, we're not losing money every month anymore. I can like pay my bills and paying rent on time. I'm like, this is great. Like our projections were like, oh, we're actually gonna make money. My investors aren't gonna like hound me for losing money every year. It's like, all right, cool. Let's keep going. So like for 3 months, we were just busier than we ever had been. It was like the healthiest the restaurant ever had been. Our cooks were getting paid. Our servers were getting paid. I was able to pay myself. My wife liked that. and it was, it just seemed like we had gotten kicked in the teeth so many times for the past like three years that it was finally our time to like succeed and like we can kind of, you know, put our head up, get a little air, breathe and keep going. Thursday night in August, I leave the restaurant around midnight. We had just moved out to the burbs, so it takes me like 30 minutes to get home. I get home to my wife, who is super pregnant at this point, who's like still up waiting for me because she just wants to see me because she never sees me anyway. My other two kids are asleep. I finally get to bed around like 1:30, and then I hear my phone buzzing around 4, thinking it was, you know, I do all of our restaurant social media, so sometimes I forget to turn that shit off. I'm like, someone's just sliding to my DMs, we'll just let it go. And it keeps going and going and going, and I look, and it's, you know, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and it's a text from my upstairs neighbor. Reverie is down an alleyway in Georgetown off of a one-way street where it's the only way I could afford to open a restaurant in D.C. was literally in the back of a building. And our neighbor upstairs is like, hey, just wanted to let you know. This, it was also like the most casual of text messages. He's like, hey, I think there's a fire downstairs. We don't know if it's from your space, but I'll keep you posted. And I was like, Okay, great. But then I see the 30 other missed calls from the fire department, my landlord, and all the other tenants in the space. And I get the call, I grab it, and they're like, Johnny, there was a fire in your space, you gotta get here. I was like, okay, so I throw on, I mean, I'm like blind, throw on my contacts, shoes, whatever, and I just, it should take me about 45 minutes to get to the restaurant. I got there in 15. And I'm just playing through my head, like, what happened? I left there 4 hours ago. What's going on? And I get into the space, and literally nothing stands. Everything's destroyed. So in a matter of 3 hours, I lost everything, like all my personal belongings, because I basically live in that restaurant. The picture of like all my, like the pictures I had of my family, of my daughter. My daughter was born, like was raised in that restaurant. She was born 10 days later. Nothing was salvageable. I mean, it didn't hit me up until probably today. What's going on? Because I'm not good at slowing down. So we opened another restaurant in the process of all this too. We had another kid. So feeling feelings is really hard when you don't stop. And I was just standing there down the alleyway, watched them like kick in all the windows. The fire gun put out. There's like 2 feet of water sitting and everything. And I literally looked at the space that I like killed myself to keep open during a pandemic that I opened over budget, underfunded. Had people chasing me down. I couldn't pay myself. And we finally had like a glimmer of hope, and it was just taken away from me. And like, and it wasn't anything in the kitchen. It was like an electrical fire. An outlet in the back caught and destroyed literally everything that I had worked for. And I just kind of stood there and like in shock, just kind of watching it. And like, I didn't cry. Not that I didn't feel, because I feel it now, but just like in disbelief. And I still was kind of like still in shock at this point too, like trying to figure out like what's going on, because your adrenaline's just pumping. But yeah, it took me a little while. Like a month later, we were already in the process of opening another restaurant. Then my wife had another kid, and I finally like took a couple of days off to kind of figure out what was going on. And I was like, oh yeah, like we kind of lost everything. The thing that I've learned from the beginning, and I think it's all really, really hard for us in the industry, is to ask for help. If you're like, you're behind on mise en place in your kitchen, like you don't want to say shit to somebody because you're going to look weak.
Yeah.
That's not true. Like if we go down, we all go down. Right. And the amount of people that reached out and that I normally would have avoided, not to say talking because I don't want to talk about it, but they wanted to offer up, you know, like we went through similar processes, you know, we did this, like it's not wrong to ask for help if you don't know what to do. Like opening a restaurant's hard enough, but then how do you navigate like a fire that decimates everything that you've worked for? So for the first time, I kind of just like, I mean, I would always admit I don't know everything, but I really just, I took every bit of advice. Like, I'm like, who should I hire? What should I do? How do I do this? How do I navigate the best possible way? So we're still like dealing with it, but I guess that's the one, like, there was like a lot of ways it could have gone. I could have just sat on that, you know, in that alleyway and said, you know what, screw it. I'm out. We'll walk away and figure out what to do, or like embrace it and just say, okay, like we'll get the insurance money. We will eventually at some point. And we'll rebuild it. And you know, we pushed through to get to a point like we were succeeding doing what we wanted to do. So fuck it, let's just keep going and go hard. But yeah, it's I'm too dumb and stubborn to stop. So probably to my own benefit, but like looking around and like pulling my head on my ass for a minute, like realizing how many people are like in the background cheering for us. Like I worked for Jose Andres for a while before he was like saving the world, but he still has time to save me. That Friday, I talked to his team. By Saturday, he called me from the Ukraine. We set up a little event over a mini bar that's going on until the end of November. So like we're doing our menu in that space. And then next year, everyone reached out. So we're going to take the team on the road while we're like rebuilding and reopening the restaurant that I like struggled to get open in the beginning. But it's not like, just embrace it as, you know, a moment to learn and like figure out like what makes us happy. We didn't follow a set of rules and, you know, check boxes to get, you know, the attention that we did. So we'll never do that. And I'm not going to stop just being who we are. But yeah, it could have destroyed me, but it's an opportunity to like restart, refresh, and kind of wipe away all the bullshit that happened over the past couple of years and just really, yeah, just cook food and have fun. So yeah.
A word on second acts. So I had a restaurant in Williamsburg and COVID happened. And unfortunately it became very clear that I wasn't gonna be able to come to terms with my landlord and that I was gonna have to close that space. Anyone who's ever worked in a restaurant, who's ever owned a business will tell you that closing something down or leaving a job can be very traumatic, and it can feel like a piece of you is being cut out. And I poured everything into that space, and I thought that I would stay open there for forever. when it became, right around the time that it became clear that I was no longer going to be able to stay open there, an opportunity presented itself through this group in Brooklyn called FIG, Food Issues Group, that did some amazing work during the pandemic to feed people in need through Street Vendor Project and also at the Ali Forney Center. So my restaurant specifically became a hub to feed people in need that were getting their meals at the Ali Forney Center. So in my saddest personal moment when woe is me, my restaurant is closing, not only was I given an opportunity to do something good, but also provide for a community that was really suffering when truthfully, okay, yeah, I was going to lose my space, but, my family was safe. I had health insurance, I had food in my fridge, and I could pay my bills. So I'm actually better off than most people in New York City. And it really put everything in perspective for me. You know, I am my business is me, but there's a lot more that can be just beyond what you do from 7 in the morning to 1 in the morning. There are other things that exist maybe outside of that. So I got to do this great work that was really fulfilling, feed people during the pandemic, and then very unceremoniously closed my restaurant down, which was really hard, and I'm not over it yet. But at least the last couple months, which I originally thought were going to be really depressing and sad, and it was during COVID, so it was very, very scary. At least it put those four walls to good work. So our next story is about, decisions being made from having a business and then maybe transitioning to something new. Clap.
I'm going to read from my phone because I have a lot of feelings and words that are associated with this topic, and I have actually never spoken about it in public or to really anyone other than my mom and my partner, but I'm like already crying. So I also wrote this on the subway here. So, one lesson I learned that I've still not learned is, not to do things by the seat of your pants, but here we are. So my name is Claire Sprouse. Hunky Dory was an all-day bar and restaurant in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. For those of you who aren't familiar with Hunky or myself, a quick spoiler alert to this story is that I closed our doors last year in October of 2021. It was just 3 years prior in 2018 that I had signed a 12-year lease at 747 Franklin Avenue in Brooklyn. I remember this period specifically because it's where an acute awareness of time, specifically time, began creeping in, and it was unlike any I had known before. Leases are funny things. You fight tooth and nail for them, pay top dollar for the lawyers and for the deposits, despite the ultimately temporary nature of them. My mind started wandering towards those restaurants you read about, forced to close after their 15, 20-year lease expires, despite how beloved they became in their neighborhood. That same neighborhood grew up around them, and it wasn't enough to prolong the life of something against the demands that newer, steeper rents demanded. And there are my friends whom I watched grind it out year after year, some lovingly, some begrudgingly, as time rolled by and the water stains collected on their bar tops. And of course, there's no denying the few that found balance in a sustainable, even sometimes lucrative life in and outside of their restaurants, although those stories are fewer and far in between than we as an industry would like to admit. Perhaps it was my Saturn returns at that time, but the cold reality of seeing this 12-year lease commitment articulated so clearly in writing, along with the escalating rent, got me thinking, what would my life look like during, at the end, and after those 12 years? I'd like to pause here and say that anyone looking to open a restaurant, I strongly urge you to sit and pause with those thoughts before signing the lease. It's always a good time instead of after. It'll save you a lot of toe in and toe out inner turmoil throughout the years to follow. I, however, did not pause to ponder or reevaluate if the dreams I had started chasing in my early 20s were the same ones now that I was in my mid-30s. In fact, I had already signed the lease as soon as the lawyer passed it my way and was well on my way to picking out paint samples at Home Depot before the ink was even dry on that personal guarantee. After a quick 2-month flip of the space, which included a never-to-be-completed novice tiling job, Hunky Dory opened on January 1st, 2019. In my experience during this opening and the many others I've been a part of, a restaurant really becomes who it is long after a lease is signed. The first year alone morphs you in countless ways. And what kind of restaurant you become in the long term will be shaped more by your surrounding neighborhood and its patrons rather than any P&L projections or best laid out business plans. Of course, a bigger shift in our short timeline came after we celebrated our 1-year anniversary with the arrival of the pandemic. And after the many necessary pivots, I hate that word, pivot, by the end of our run, we had been more hunky in a pandemic than hunky before the pandemic. This pandemic version of hunky was far from what the before looked like, but it was weirdly also its most lauded. We had countless awards and many write-ups. It allowed me to reinvent the way I wanted a restaurant or our industry to be ran. No tipping, equal wages, 4-day work weeks, and the opportunities to cross-train or have upward mobility throughout every member of our staff. We hosted pop-ups. We built community. I gave so much to our community without really saving anything for myself. Both versions of Hunky were beautiful in their own ways. The community that was created there, like I said, did not come at a cost. My partner, who also owned a restaurant, actually two restaurants, we met up one night in year 2 of the pandemic. We had both worked 18-hour workdays after countless 18-hour workdays before that. We were desperately, lazily trying to drink a bottle of wine, both exhausted mentally, physically, and emotionally. We talked about our future as a family, and he asked me if we honestly thought that we could have a child working the way that we worked in the industry that we worked at that time. I remember it not being a question of defeat or full of any implication or expectation of either of us, but one grounded in the maturity and clarity of our realities. And my heart and my mind returned to those nagging questions of who I am as a restaurant owner and if that was the present or future that I still wanted for myself. A few months later, I decided to close Hunky, but not without much more inner turmoil. In my 20-year hospitality career, I had built a reputation that I had truly valued, one built on sustainability, one on ethics, one on honor. I was never the person to put in their notice before a year at a place. I always covered people's shifts. And I called a friend that day because I had a lot of turmoil about not being able to repay my investor. Another lesson, don't have your investor be your ex-boyfriend. And he, as a restaurant owner, having closed 2 restaurants out of the 6 that he owned at that time, told me that while he knew that we as people of what we thought were people of honor and respect, and knew that we valued those investments and those stakeholders in our restaurant relationships, but that you can only do so much in a pandemic. And at the end of the day, you have to choose yourself. I announced us closing at the end of October. Shortly after we closed, I was asked if I would consider writing a hunky-dory book. But looking back, I don't know who or what a book would celebrate or grieve, or how it could even encapsulate all of what we did or who we were, or even in my part in it and what I felt like it took from me to make it happen. Like I said, I hadn't spoken about it until now, and it's weird how funny how people create their own narratives in the absence of you speaking up for yourself. But I will say I don't regret any of it, or the choices that I made, or doing it in the first place. I don't regret getting caught in the inertia of my younger self's dreams. I just regret not being able to hold the space for my older present self's realities and desires until just recently. Building a family and building a community and building the sustainability of myself was what I most wanted. It is what I most wanted, and I couldn't do it as a restaurant owner, and I didn't want to. It wasn't a matter of my ability, but again, it was a matter of my wants. And that's a really important distinction. Like I said, we closed Hunky Dory a week, almost a year ago. It'll be a year next Monday. It's also the 4-week birthday of my newborn. And I'm grateful I was able to sunset my business on my own terms, especially in the midst of so many restaurants closing in the pandemic and never reopening again. I got to say goodbye, and I got to say hello to a new chapter in my life, and to be in service to my family and to my community in real ways, in sustainable ways. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire, for sharing that. One more big round of applause for all of our storytellers. It's pretty impossible to encapsulate all the emotions and all the stories that we've told tonight, because the world of restaurants and hospitality and small business owners is like, it's everything. Like, it spans the gamut, right? Like, you pour everything you have into it. And at the end of the day, it's so intertwined with so many people's lives. But I'm gonna leave you with this thought, which is many years ago, I ran a restaurant with my brother in the Hamptons. And we, on July 4th, my brother's wife was pregnant and he had to leave. And he said, all right, you got this? And I said, I do not got this. Where are you going? And he said, I'm going back to Brooklyn. And so I was left with this enormous restaurant with a lot of people that were relying on me to lead them, and I wasn't ready. And they were looking to me, and what I realized is, like, I actually was gonna look back to them and let them lead me. And it became super apparent when, based on a accidental, terrible confluence of situations, the entire restaurant and backyard got sat essentially at the same time, and 460 people got sat. And the ticket machine, which is the, like, nightmare of anyone that ever works in a restaurant, just started hammering, tickets, pouring. And as the tickets are coming out, we kind of started laughing, you know, like this is insurmountable, you know, this is too many tickets. And, you know, it's like the way the expo worked was like I was expo, but there was a guy in the inside of the kitchen and he was sort of like the inside expo, right? So he's sort of like relaying to his line mates what's going on because he's the pastor on that side. And he goes, we'll cook, they'll eat, everyone will leave happy, right? And I said to the GM, I was like, get us a bottle. We all took, the tickets were just pouring. We all took a nice shot, and I just said, cook. And everyone, whatever was coming off their station, they just made it, which is like obviously the exact opposite of what you're supposed to do, right? Like, so the guy on grill just like cooked chickens and steaks and threw them in the window, and pizza, threw stuff in the window. But I think what's so amazing about restaurants is that, you know, you've got people here that are like at the top, right? And they're sharing their stories, but the fabric of the restaurant is really everybody that's there and everyone together. And so it's really, you know, you're only as good as everyone that is there around you. So whether or not you open or close or reopen or whatever it might be, you know, if it's your idea or not your idea, you have to rely on other people. And there's a million lessons to be learned along the way when you're at the top and when you're the leader. And a lot of those lessons you learn from everyone else around you at the restaurant. And I think that's what's so cool about this event is that we've all heard stories from so many different people and they've shared their story. And hopefully it's been, you know, entertaining, but also I hope that you've taken something away from these stories, whether you're a small business owner or not. And when people are listening to this podcast, you know, you're going to take things away from all these stories and you're going to realize that these like really serious emotional moments that happen for these people, like they're sharing them because it was cathartic, hopefully for them, but also because like in this industry, we're like a giving industry. All we do is give. So what they're doing is sharing a part of themselves so that hopefully someone that comes afterwards can learn something from it. So I hope you enjoyed this HRN storytelling event. I hope you learned something. I hope you took something away from it. And thank you so much for everyone for sharing your stories, because that is really hard. And a lot of these, all these stories were intense and very personal. And that is what it is to, you know, be a small business owner. It is intense and it is personal and it is unbelievably hard. So kudos for sharing your story and thank you all for listening and being here. Thank you.
The Line is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners just like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.